Pre-recorded, completely unscripted, and about as organised as the thought processes of some members of the Australian Senate, you're listening to news, views and opinions on events from here at home and around the globe on politics, business and society in general. This is the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove.
Welcome, dear listener. We are up to episode 68 of the Iron Fist and the Velvet Glove. I am, of course, the Iron Fist, and with me, standing in, as he often does, the 12th man, Paul. You're looking well.
Thanks, Trevor. You're looking fantastic as usual.
Great to have you. So, dear listener, last week I got into trouble. We went a bit long, so I'll try and keep this one down to an hour. My wife just stopped at the hour 10 mark and said, "That's it, I've had enough," and she refused to listen to any more. So with that slap on the wrist, we'll try and keep it within time. But first thing to talk about, Paul, is last Wednesday I went with I went to QUT for a lecture about voluntary euthanasia, and with me was Deep Throat and another character from the secular party who I'm just going to refer to as the Fugitive. So we'll add him to our cast here at Iron Fist Velvet Glove. So the Iron Fist, the Fugitive, and Deep Throat. A really interesting talk at QUT by a lady called Jocelyn Downey, who's a world expert on voluntary euthanasia. She's Canadian, and they've introduced laws in Canada, and she's very well versed in what's happening there, here, and around the world. And first off, free lecture. We get there half an hour early, free canapes, and free drinks.
Wow.
How good's that?
So, what kind of drinks did you get?
You could have beer or wine or whatever. Yeah.
Not bad.
Yeah. So, your taxpayer...
To get you in the mood for a gentle departure from this world.
Yes, yes. Mind you, there were some members in the audience who possibly did not partake because they were,
teetotal.
Perhaps, yes. More on them later. Okay. But she was very interesting. Sometimes you think, they managed to do it in Canada, then... surely we could do it here. The difference is that it was basically a constitutional issue over there that meant that voluntary euthanasia and a Bill of Rights issue that meant that it had to be implemented and religious groups couldn't stop it. So a court decision came down called Carter and basically said no voluntary euthanasia laws are going to have to be in place, and you guys are just going to work out some of the minor details. Mm. So they sort of bypassed a lot of the opposition that way.
So the religious objections weren't permitted to block
correct.
The process.
Yeah. Mm. So, just in the mechanics of different things, they would put their two cents worth in, but they couldn't actually stop it happening. Mm. So... things like requesting religious exemptions for hospitals and stuff, they obviously did that, and they tried to make it as difficult as possible at different mm-hmm. points. So it's a very interesting lecture, and that will go online at some stage, and we'll post a link to it. And and I'm going to wait for it to come online to talk more in depth. She was talking about the exemptions and the difficulties that occur when you start to allow exemptions, particularly hospitals, mm-hmm. and say, well, this hospital doesn't have to conduct voluntary euthanasia mm-hmm. procedures. Yeah. And awful things happen because you then have to transfer people from hospitals to another hospital, which can be extremely difficult in the circumstances and extremely painful for people.
And possibly even fatal in some cases.
Well, that's... well, no, these people are not actually... it won't actually be fatal, if only it would to some extent. They're obviously...
I was trying to be ironic.
Yeah, you were. Okay. So she gave some different examples of the problems when you start to allow exemptions. So more on that later. But at the end of the talk, she was so learned, so good, and I managed to ask the first question in the Q&A afterwards.
Well done.
Mm. The Fugitive managed to get the microphone, so he was very good, and handed it to me. And I asked, During your talk, you briefly mentioned opposition from religious groups. Were they the main opposition, and were there any other opposition groups? And she said, well, actually, they were pretty much the only opposition with the religious groups, and there were some people who were not religious who were worried about the slippery slope, but the evidence just overwhelmed them that there was no argument for a slippery slope.
Yeah, and we've had the discussion in the media in Australia from time to time, and I recall there was one Q&A session. It could have been up to a couple of years ago, but I recall Maxine McHugh, a person I greatly admire, coming out against voluntary euthanasia, which surprised me at the time.
Right.
But
the slippery slope being that people will be bopping people off unnecessarily in order for quick access to the estate, and the system will be abused, and people will use it to their own evil ends. And the Carter case, and also I think something from the Royal Society of Canada, did very significant investigations of all the available evidence around the world. Experts were brought in, and there was no evidence of any slippery slope occurring in any jurisdiction where these laws are currently operating. So that was really interesting. So I asked that question, and she said, well, basically the slippery slope argument was just debunked, and that group who were genuinely concerned came around. Then after my question, and of course they asked you to announce who you were and where you were from. So I said, you know, Trevor Bell, Secular Party. Next guy was, you know, minister or pastor such and such from the blah, blah church. And these people are so rude, Paul. Like, it's a Q&A. You're there to ask a question. But you had to start with a ramble and a rant about making all these comments about how there really is a slippery slope. And he started going on and on about circumstances in Belgium and other all sorts of other things. You know, he's going for up to 5 minutes, which is quite a long time.
It's a long time to ask a question.
And
Did you take it as a comment?
Well, the people there are saying, could you please make your question? You know, we've got other, you know, there's lots of other people in the room asking. And so rude. And eventually he asked his question, and, you know, she dealt with that. A couple of other questions around the room. And then there was another guy who was clearly from some religious group. And he, again, just went off on a rant. You would have thought it was his lecture that we were attending. And even before he started, I think they knew who he was and said, please, can you just ask a question? We don't want comments. But totally ignored the request. Yeah. And just, so I couldn't help myself. I was just enraged. And no, I didn't go up and punch him on the nose. But I was loudly saying to the fugitive, you know, is this guy going to ask a question? I'm getting really sick of listening to this guy. And then at different points, I had to turn around to him and just sort of yell at him.
Oh, did you?
Ask your question.
Well, I agree with you. It's poor form. In a public presentation.
Rude. Yes.
Where somebody is there to share some information or some insights with an audience.
Yes.
And somebody in the audience tries to sort of derail the conversation.
Yes. I subsequently learned from Deep Throat that this particular guy was from the ACL.
Mm.
He was the guy, when Deep Throat went to the Baptist church and felt quite intimidated because a guy was standing at the end of the aisle watching everybody and all the rest, he was that same guy. Mm. So we came face-to-face with Darth Vader in this room. But it was such a civilized environment of really learned people and beautifully, the religious groups just came to form, more or less, you know, proving my question in the first place, that they are the opposition. Mm. And the other thing was lots of women in the room, lots and lots of, you know, 90% women in the room.
90%, really?
Yes. I think it's a big issue for women and a big vote getter for groups like ours, that this is one thing that will motivate, to a large extent, say our Facebook page, the followers we know from statistics are largely men.
Mm.
And women, and that seemed to be the case for most political parties and atheist groups.
There seems to be a theory that men are generally more interested in politics than women.
Well, perhaps they don't like the conflict that goes on sometimes on a Facebook page.
The aggressiveness.
Yes, it's just not to their taste.
Yeah.
By, you know, all generalisations, of course.
They are.
But, yeah, that's definitely an issue, I think, that will sway the female vote in times to come. So there was that. So, so that was our excursion for QUT. More about that at another time when I get to review her lecture about the exemptions.
Excuse me.
Also, since we last, well, actually the weekend before that, we had our secular party meeting, 12th man, and you and I had an altercation across the table.
I think that's overstating it a little bit, Trevor.
It is overstating it. But we were discussing, well, we were literally discussing the baker who was going to bake, who's forced to bake a wedding cake
that's
for a gay couple.
And you were outraged that the baker couldn't be legally pressured into baking the cake for the gay couple, right?
Well, I said that the baker should be, and you...
Should be compelled.
Well, should face censure if
that's a kind of compulsion, isn't it?
Yeah.
In other words...
Well, no, I'm not going to make him actually be forced to bake a cake.
If they don't bake the cake, they're going to be prosecuted.
But yes, they should be fined.
And I came to the defence of the baker...
Yes.
..on the grounds that why should anyone be forced to do something that their heart really isn't in, you know?
Yes.
And I don't know. I still take the view that as a private business, you know, a private creative business.
So just to set this up, background, dear listener, the classic case which has been talked about in America, and there's been a sort of a similar case now in Northern Ireland where classically a gay couple goes to a bakery and says, we'd like a wedding cake, please. And, you know, it's going to have a husband and husband or a wife and wife on the wedding cake and some gay sort of sentiments on it. And the bakery, which normally makes wedding cakes, says, no, I'm not going to do that because I have a conscientious objection or a religious objection of some sort to
like
gay marriage
people, yeah.
And not going to make it. Yeah. So you feel, of course, why would anybody want their cake made by somebody who feels that way?
Yes.
And that practically you would just walk out of that cake shop and go to another one.
Exactly.
Right.
What's to stop them?
Yes.
I mean, why would they want to have their special wedding cake? I mean, it's a very, very uniquely special day in people's lives.
Yes.
Why would they want somebody who didn't like them, who wasn't with them in spirit, to bake their damn cake, you know?
But in practicality, I agree with you. Why would you? You'd go somewhere else.
Yeah. Look, can I make one more point, Trevor? And the other point is, okay, when I was 15, I read George Orwell's 1984, and it affected me deeply.
Yes.
And I had, you know, I grew up with this vision of the totalitarian state looming in the distance in the future.
Yes.
And, do you know, to be honest, while I think... You know me well enough to know that I'm all in favour of treating people equally and treating them decently, no matter what they look like or where they come from or what language they speak, whatever.
Yes.
However, I'm a little bit wary of a political trend that relies on legal sanction and compulsion to enforce a religious, to enforce a political project. Do you know what I mean?
Yes.
In order to create the equal society, are we going to compel everybody to act as we think they should? And that's my problem with compelling the bakers to bake the cake for the gay couple.
Yes.
I really think at some point we have to pull back with legal sanction and say, surely there's a better way of approaching this problem, because the problem stems from people's attitudes and their perceptions of other people. For me, rather than address it with legal sanction, we should be addressing it from kindergarten. Showing children as they grow up in a secular educational environment that people are, after all just people beneath the surface. And that, you know, we all deserve to be treated well and equally.
Yes.
So rather than compelling those hapless bakers to bake the wedding cake, we should be...
Hapless bakers. So we've got...
Well, I've got to
we've got,
put in a...
We've got the Ku Klux Klan and now hapless bakers. That's right.
But, you know, I think we should be starting at kindergarten and raising children to be more open-minded and aware so that when they grow up to become bakers, to inherit their parents' or their grandparents' bakery shop,
yes,
they won't have any problem with the gay wedding cake. You know what I mean? I think that's a much
I know what you mean, Paul.
Better approach.
If we all just sit around the campfire and sing Kumbaya, it'll all be okay.
Yeah. But seriously, I mean, at what point should legal sanctions stop and gentle encouragement and, you know, just education? We all know. I mean, I recall when I was a kid that...
You could say this about any number of laws.
Yes, but look, you know, we do have laws against littering, and we don't have much litter in the streets anymore. But I'm of a view that... The reason we don't have much litter in the streets these days is because generations of Australians have been educated that littering is a kind of secular sin.
Right.
You know what I mean? So people grow up, they don't want to litter because they think it's just not a nice thing to do.
Yes.
It's not, they don't not litter because they'll get fined. They don't litter because they don't want to litter anymore.
Right.
I think the same approach can be taken with the gay wedding cake.
Right. Let's just go back a little bit because I want to explore the reasons why. So, and I like to do this with some other alternative sort of similar scenarios. Mm-hmm. So, to me, I'm likening this to, you know, the activism of Martin Luther King and America with what happened to the black people in America. I mean, black people were told in certain shops, I'm not serving you.
Yes.
And we say quite clearly now, without having to think too hard about it, that that's not acceptable. Mm. So...
But he persuaded people with good arguments.
So my question to you, though, is could a baker say to a black couple, I'm not doing a wedding cake for you because you're black?
Look, frankly, that would be extremely objectionable and distasteful.
Yes.
But do I think people should be prosecuted for running their business how they want? I'm a little bit reluctant to say yes.
Really?
Yeah, really, really. Yeah. And look, as distasteful and objectionable as that attitude and that behaviour is,
yes.
As I said...
Here's the problem, Paul, is if enough people do that, and deny service to groups because they just don't like them, that group is deprived of power. They're genuinely deprived of power.
Yeah. Look, I understand that it's a bad thing.
And so that would be just condoning the heel on the neck of the downtrodden and disempowering them. I mean, it's about power. If you allow enough people to do that...
Who's allowing enough people? I mean...
Well, you, because you're saying it's open slather to any business to reject people based on features that they have absolutely no control over.
But you're assuming that if one bakery refuses to bake a wedding cake for a gay couple, or lots of bakeries would refuse. I'm not convinced that that would happen because I think generally Australians have a more tolerant attitude.
I don't have to assume that most will. I mean, just enough to... If you have enough, then that takes power away from either the gay couple or the black couple. It makes their lives more difficult. It's a signal from our society saying that this is okay to do.
I'm not sure that it is, Trevor. Not sure that it is because we don't have laws against every single thing that we might think is not good in society.
So in America, with the racial difficulties and with black people being banned from shops,
mm-hmm.
you wouldn't have asked for any change to the law to force an Alabama shopkeeper to serve a black person.
Look, I probably would have asked for changes to the law for key public services like education, health, transport, yes.
What about a shop? Just a general shop?
I'm not sure if I would go that far, to be honest.
Right. What if every shop in town in Alabama is not allowing a black person to buy from them?
Well, look, I dare say some enterprising individuals would have opened a shop that did serve black people and they would have done a roaring trade.
Well, they would have charged the black people more.
Not necessarily. Not if they were black people themselves.
You're assuming a perfect free market here.
No, well, you're assuming a totally evil world.
But I don't have to assume it. Like, in Alabama, that was the case. Like, I'm referring to a situation that actually was happening. So I don't have to.
Yeah, and, you know, I don't know if you could fairly claim that every single business in Alabama was discriminatory. I don't know. I wasn't there, and I don't suppose you were either.
No, but they may well have said, could be pretty confident that nearly every shop said, either I'm not serving you or you go to the black counter where we serve blacks.
You read To Kill a Mockingbird, I assume.
Yes.
Was every person, every white person in the book a racist?
No.
No. So I dare say there would have been a growing tide of decent people who would have seen the evil in that discrimination and would have started serving, you know, non-white people.
See, I would have thought I would have got you on that argument. I prior to this, in preparation, thought, okay, I'll just use the, you know, would you allow that to happen to blacks and in a general store? And I thought you would have said yes, and I thought I'd now be needling down into the differences. Okay.
I'm just over legalizing human behaviour.
Right. Trevor. Okay. Let's divert away then from the cake in the shop now to quasi or semi government functions.
So marriage celebrants.
Yes.
Yes.
So my view, as enunciated previously, is this: that we should say that marrying people is really a government function. We need to be sure that people genuinely consent, and we need to have a record that they have agreed to the marriage, and it's got enormous implications in our legal system whether people are married or not. So we can't allow it to be unregulated. We need to regulate this to some extent because it's an important function.
I'm not convinced it is that a private marriage celebrant is a government, you know, even quasi-government employee. Because the actual registration of the marriage is done in a branch of the bureaucracy.
It's the recording of it.
Yeah, those people definitely should not be, and I assume they don't, discriminate on any basis.
But for example, you need to know there's full and proper consent by both parties.
Mm-hmm.
So it's extremely important, and you wouldn't want you would have to have some training of people to say to them, when you're going to marry somebody...
They do a course, don't they?
Yes.
It's like...
That's a regulation of some sort.
I'm not sure if it's a regulation exactly, but, you know...
Okay. Well, let me finish stating my position and then you can tell me...
It's like doing a course in workplace health and safety.
Yes.
You do a course. Yes. You know, it probably takes a couple of weeks.
Yes.
You get a certificate at the end. You pay your $2,000 or whatever it costs you.
Yes.
And you're certified.
You're qualified.
To check workplace health and safety. You know, you might say, well, that's an important function, so it's an extension of a government regulation. In a sense, it sort of has legal status. But, you know, there are a lot of marriage celebrants out there, Trevor, for goodness sake, you know. Wouldn't you want somebody who was with you
in
the project?
I'm sensing in all of this, there's a lot of other options. So what's the problem? You can buy a wedding cake anywhere.
There are other cake shops.
And yes. So there are other marriage celebrants. So what's the problem?
That's my position.
Okay. So if I'm in a small town way out west and there is only one shop or there is only one marriage celebrant...
Mm-hmm.
And that person refuses service to me because of some sexual preference or colour of my skin.
Mm-hmm.
Is that okay?
Look, people who live in remote areas are used to
being discriminated against.
Let me finish. They're used to inconvenience. And they will, if necessary, travel to the next one horse
town. Okay.
For the marriage celebrant who is happy to do the ceremony with them.
I'm raised in Brisbane, in a big city, and I'm transferred as a teacher to a one horse town. So I'm not used to it. Okay.
Get used to it. Because life, you know, is not all set up for your convenience, is it?
So that would be okay in
the teaching profession. We call it a hardship posting. So you're going to have to put up with a little hardship, or just postpone your wedding, Trevor.
Postpone your wedding
until vacation, when you can travel to a place where there is a marriage celebrant who's happy to do it.
Right. So even
how hard is that?
But I want a dozen eggs, a loaf of bread, and some sugar, and the local shop won't serve me
because you're gay.
Yeah, or I'm black.
Or a black guy.
Yeah.
Okay.
And there's another general store 350 kilometres down the road.
Yeah.
But nobody else in town, except for me, as the only gay black fella in town, is refused service.
Yeah.
Is that okay? Should they be allowed to do that?
You know, ethically, no, of course not.
Legally.
Just reluctant to throw the law at people for every attitudinal problem they have. You know?
Is there some mutual agreement here that we say to people who are running businesses, we're providing a civilization and a support service for you? We've got
who is we?
The government and society. We're providing electricity, poles, roads, water, sewerage, a legal system. We've got a policeman around the corner, if somebody steals from you, who will come in and help sort things out. We've got a whole infrastructure that's there, whether by design or not, to help you with your business that you take advantage of in your day-to-day activities. Like, people don't steal from you because they know that shoplifting's an offence and the local cop will throw them in jail. They know that if they don't pay their bill, you can take them to a court, which we have set up for them. Isn't it a small price for society to pay? You know what? If you want the benefit of a civilization, then in return, there are a few things our civilization requires of you.
Mm. It's expected.
Wouldn't that be a morally ethical view that would justify forcing some... There's a shaking of the head, dear
morally
listener.
Morally and ethically, the person would be wrong to refuse service.
Right.
My favoured approach would be that surely the other people who shop there, hearing about this discrimination, would put a little bit of moral pressure on the shopkeeper to change his approach. You know, they would say, "Well, you know, what do you got against the gay black guy? After all, you know, why won't you serve him?" And he was, you know, if he comes out with some sort of horrible bigoted attitude, they might take their business elsewhere as well. You know what I mean? I think there's a different kind of pressure that can be brought to bear on people, and we all know about consumer advocacy and boycotting of companies. It has an effect.
Yeah, but sometimes it doesn't. And in small towns with power the way it is, it doesn't necessarily work that way. So
look, I am sympathetic to your view, but I just don't think compelling people with legal sanction for every objectionable or distasteful thing they do is the right approach.
All right. That's all right, 12th man, I thought I was going to nail you to the wall, but I'm going to have to sit back and try and think of...
To be continued.
Yes, to be continued later.
Okay. And look, as I said at the meeting, I'm open to be persuaded. I'm still just really uncomfortable with the idea of legal sanctions for everything, you know?
Mm.
Because who decides, you know?
Well, society. objectively, rationally makes these decisions.
Yeah, but, you know, I reckon...
Smacking of... sounding like a cultural relativist if you're saying nobody can make a decision as to right or wrong, Paul.
No. I reckon if you looked hard enough, Trevor, you would be able to find a few laws on the statutes that you found objectionable, that you thought were out of place or over the top.
Of course.
And for me, that would be another example.
But, you know, it's part of the price you pay for an overall civilization.
Yeah, I don't know. I'm not convinced by that argument.
Clearly you're not. All right. Okay, Paul. So
Let's move on.
That was that one. article from the Sydney Morning Herald. The Nationals and their fringe views are holding Australia to ransom, 12 men.
Yeah.
A few key points from this article is that basically the Nationals get bugger all votes, but they're wielding extraordinary power because the votes they have are sort of concentrated in small localities that manages to get representatives over the line.
Indeed.
And the ethos of the party...
Well, yeah, I was surprised when I read it this afternoon, the part about the party being essentially being there to keep Australia as a God-fearing Christian country serving the Queen.
Yeah, well, this is from the Constitution of the National Party. The first object listed before any other, before economic growth or trade benefits for farmers, is to promote within Australia, quote, a society based on Christian ethics and loyalty to the Crown, unquote. So that's the number one agenda of the National Party, and certainly guys like George Christensen are taking that on board.
It sounds like something from the, you know, the First World War or something, doesn't it?
It does, yeah. Well, perhaps it was written well before then and hasn't been changed.
How old is the... I mean, they were the Country Party, of course, originally. Do you know how old they are?
I have no idea. No idea. But anyway, interesting article, which is basically having a go at the Nationals and saying it's ridiculous how much power they can wield.
It's disproportionate to the number of votes they actually get.
Yeah. And it has a small comment about the guns with the Adler shotgun. And I just like this line here. Apparently, requiring people to pause between killings is too much to ask. That was a good line from Tim Dick, the author of that article. Tough man, we have previously talked about the chess grandmaster. Well, can you pronounce her name?
I can't, because I thought it was Nazi, but surely she doesn't say it like that.
Yeah, Nazi Pagidzi. And you remember, dear listener, that the chess authorities, in their wisdom, have decided to hold the world championships in Iran, I think it was. Yes. And, of course, women are required to wear full headgear and...
Well, the hijab, anyway.
Yes.
But they're not required to cover their faces.
Apparently. So this one of the leading players is just refusing to go on the basis that she's not going to wear any garment like that.
Yeah, just as I was hoping that Julie Bishop would refuse to cover her head when she went to Iran some months back. But, of course, she wore her Boy George outfit, didn't she?
She did have some sort of...
She wore a funny hat that looked like, with a veil over it, it looked like something Boy George would put on for a show.
Didn't see the hat. I just saw her sort of...
It was quite funny.
Lightweight scarf type.
But yeah, I mean, I was deeply disappointed that she actually kowtowed to those people, those theocrats, those theocratic dictators.
Anyway, point of this article is that during the Olympics, when certain Muslim women wore their hijab or headscarf garments during...
American Muslim athletes,
During competing at the Olympics, the left were just falling over themselves, applauding the heroics of these women.
So heroic.
And the statement that was being made and the empowerment that was happening.
Yeah.
And the article makes the point, well, where are these people now applauding this woman who's refusing to go to Iran and put on a headscarf?
Yes.
And there's complete silence.
That's right.
Mm.
And, you know, from time to time, we see photographs of the demonstrations in Iran, in Tehran, the capital, and probably other cities, but I don't really know, of women demonstrating without any head covering, demonstrating the edict that had been issued, commanding every woman when they're on the street to be covering their heads. And thousands of Iranian women came out into the streets to demonstrate against that edict.
Yes, when it was initially introduced.
That's right. Yes. Now, why do Western liberals think that they applaud a woman who dons that symbol of what some people would interpret as the oppression and the, you know, the oppression of women,
yes,
and not applaud a woman who refuses, as many Iranian women did,
yes,
initially, to submit to that sort of, you know, it's a compulsory attire in public, isn't it?
Yes.
It's not something that they necessarily voluntarily choose.
Yeah, yeah. Well, in the first case with the Olympians, it was virtue signalling, perhaps.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is virtue signalling.
Yeah. And a sort of a double standard is being applied there. So I thought that was interesting.
Very interesting.
Twelfth Man, I know you're big on the topic of moral relativism, and it's one of my favourites at the moment. And I heard this originally on a Richard Feidler podcast, and I found the article by Simon Blackburn. And dear listener, if you're ever sort of, if you're still confused about what moral relativism and moral absolutism is, then this story will just sort of put it all in perspective for you. So, you've got a high-powered ethics institute presenting a panel of representatives from the great religions. First, the Buddhists spoke of the ways to achieve calm, the mastery of desire, the path of enlightenment, and the panelists all said, "Wow, terrific! If that works for you, that's great." Then the Hindu gets up, talks about the cycles of suffering and birth and rebirth, the teachings of Krishna and the ways to release, and they all said, "Wow, terrific! If that works for you, that's great." And so on until the Catholic priest spoke of the message of Jesus Christ, the promise of salvation and the way to life eternal. And they all said, "Wow, terrific. If that works for you, that's great." But at that point, the Catholic priest thumped the table and shouted, "No, it's not a question of if it works for me. It's the true word of the living God. And if you don't believe it, you're all damned to hell." At that point, they all said, "Wow, terrific. If that works for you, that's great." There's moral relativism for you in a nutshell, if you're ever wondering what it is, and sort of apologising for moral absolutism at the same time. Yeah. So, great story. So that's that one on moral relativism. We will get back to culture, you know, towards the end. Donald Trump, has in the last, since the most recent debate, has said it's rigged, and he's not going to accept the verdict unless he wins.
That's
in
right.
In which case, it's okay.
Yeah.
And an interesting article in The Conversation by Brian Cranston, titled "Trump Claims the Election is Rigged." Is it? Question mark. And what he just points out is a few interesting things. Like the conclusion, of course, is not that that Donald Trump is correct, that it's rigged against him. But there are some quirks in the system that people may not be aware of. So, so the presidential election uses an electoral college, with 48 of the nation's 50 states adopting a winner-take-all approach to Election Day. These states do not apportion their electoral college votes, which means if Hillary Clinton wins California by a single vote, then she will win all of that state's 55 electoral college votes, and Trump will win none.
So Trump has a point.
So, well, no, he doesn't, because that's the system.
That's the system they have.
Yes.
Yeah. So rigged implies that somebody is manipulating the numbers to achieve a particular outcome.
That's right, an unfair outcome. So So when somebody votes in America, in the state of California, for example, they are actually, when they make their votes, and say, for example, Hillary Clinton wins, then there's a person who is then in charge of those 55 votes of California, and they meet with the other people from the other states who are in charge of their state's votes and all get together, and then the votes are counted that way. So you're actually creating these electoral college votes that somebody on the behalf of California then takes to a meeting after the election with all these other state representatives. Very interesting situation.
Yeah, look, I've long been puzzled by the American electoral system.
And not all states have a legal compulsion for that person to actually follow the vote of...
The majority of the
vote. Yes.
Really?
Yes, not all states do. So, I might have skipped ahead too much here, but...
There are some Americans, I believe, who are not happy with the electoral college system either.
Yeah, well, once we've finished explaining it, they'll probably... There's some good reasons not to be happy with it, yeah.
So all our American friends out there, we're presenting this for your benefit.
We are. Well, just for our Australian friends out there, all 108 of them on Facebook, apparently, for your benefit as well. This is, you know, one of the aims of this podcast that we declared sort of on day one was... just enough that when people are at a dinner party or standing around the water cooler, that they have a useful insight into world events. Mm-hmm. So this is one of those that you can sort of... The other thing was, you know, if you're a contestant in a beauty contest and you're asked a tricky question, you can come out with something interesting if you've been following this podcast.
Yeah. One of the best I've seen, a cartoon at a beauty contest, and the man with the microphone says to the contestant, you know, it's one of these general knowledge quiz type qualifying
yes.
sections.
Yeah.
What's the capital of Texas?
Yes.
And she replies, T.
That's good. Is it Dallas or Houston? Or because sometimes...
No. It's that place that Janis Joplin's from, isn't it?
Because sometimes the capital...
No, it's not one of the big, more famous cities.
Because the capital of California is not the obvious LA or San Francisco. I think it starts with S, like...
Like Sacramento
or... Something like that.
I don't know, to be honest.
Trick question on a beauty contest, yeah. But T, that's a good answer, yeah. Okay, so also in this American system... power is granted to each state to determine how they will manage the election on election day. And the person in charge in each state, well, in 38 states, the person in charge is known as the State Secretary of State, not to be confused with the more famous federal cabinet position. In 35 states, this position is a partisan elected position. So basically, in two-thirds of the country, the person responsible for managing the integrity of elections is affiliated with a major political party.
That's scandalous. I mean, it would be in Australia, wouldn't it?
Yes.
I mean, we have an independent electoral commission.
Yes.
Who are supposed to be scrupulously non-partisan.
Exactly. So these individuals, if they're not fair-minded... can do things in the running of the election. So if, for example, they are a pro-Republican, they can make sure that Democrat areas have very few voting booths and very few staff.
Yeah.
So in 2012, for example, some of the wait times were up to 9 hours to vote because of the way it had been rigged by partisan people in charge of the election.
And it's done state by state, isn't
it? So each state can be
possibly county by county.
Yes. Yeah, and they can have their own different systems. Like some states had a sort of a machine and a lever that you would pull and would punch cards and things.
That was a feature of the election between Bush and Gore, wasn't it?
Yeah, and I think it was Florida.
It was in Florida. And Florida is one of the big states with lots of electoral college votes.
Yes.
And that was the one that decided it for George W. Bush, I believe.
Correct.
And his brother was the governor and had control of the legal apparatus
there you go.
That were in charge of the contentious counting of the votes.
Yep.
And he swung it for his brother. I mean, it's widely believed that he swung it in his brother's favour.
Yeah. So, you know, if a pro-Hillary person did something similar, Donald Trump, you know, could be right. I mean, it's open to abuse when you've got party...
It certainly sounds that way.
Partisan people in charge, it's open to abuse. And the article talks about different swing states and which parties are actually in charge. And, the Electoral College is a group of people who gather to cast their votes for the various presidential candidates. It's very similar to the way that they sort of work out their party delegates in the first place. So when Americans are casting their votes for presidential candidates, they're actually casting votes for electors who will cast votes for the candidates. Technically, the electors do not have to vote for anyone. The Constitution does not require them to do so. And throughout the history of presidential elections, some have indeed voted for someone else.
Really?
The Electoral College meets a few weeks after the presidential election. Mostly their meeting is a formality. And just in the comments section, Brian, in responding to somebody else, said that 21 states do not have any laws compelling an elector to vote the way the population did, while 29 states do have laws requiring vote adherence.
Quite staggering, isn't it?
Amazing.
That they would have such a loose system for such an important function.
Yes. Yeah.
Staggering.
Yeah. So, that's interesting. Also, I've got another link here for you, dear listener. It's a report by the U.S. Commission on International Religious Freedom, an independent, bipartisan U.S. government advisory body that monitors religious freedom worldwide, looks at countries of particular concern, which would be a CPC. These are countries whose governments engage in or tolerate particularly severe violations of religious freedom that are systematic, ongoing, and egregious. So a country that is a CPC, country of particular concern, is systematically restricting religious freedom. Mm-hmm. And there's a list here, 12 man, countries that were already designated CPC, new countries that they are saying should be designated as CPC, and then countries that are on the borderline are getting close to being designated as CPC. Mm-hmm. And I counted them up, and there's 27 of them, of which five are kind of totalitarian dictatorship states, like Cuba and, well, I'll put China in that category, and Burma. Mm-hmm. But of the 27, 16 are Muslim majority countries, and only three of them are Christian.
Oh, really? Yeah. Which three are Christian?
That would be Eritrea, the Central African Republic, and Russia.
Oh, well, Russia's not really a surprise, but the other two... that's interesting.
Yeah.
Eritrea.
Mm. Yeah. So they were the majority Christian ones, but very much dominated by the religion of peace, not with systematic restriction of religion.
Yes.
12th man, I know that you're, a student of, or you're intrigued by university campuses and the whole sombrero thing where they were banned. And here's an article where a student union at Brock University recently prepared a list of prohibited costumes for its annual Halloween bash.
Yeah.
The list features any form of headdress, costumes that mock suicide or rape. Those depicting transgender activist Caitlyn Jenner or outfits featuring a culture's traditional attire, e.g. the sombrero in that.
Yeah, or even a Japanese kimono.
Mm. All on the basis of cultural appropriation, I believe, Twelfth Man. What's your thoughts on cultural appropriation as a theory?
Oh, well, I think you well know my thoughts on cultural appropriation.
I don't know. I thought I knew your ideas on small shops in rural towns, but you might surprise me.
Okay. I've been to Japan and I've seen lots of Japanese gentlemen not wearing their traditional robes, and I thought, how dare they? How dare they wear Western-style business suits? And they're everywhere. You know, they flagrantly violate our cultural rights to exclusive use of business suits.
Yes. I don't know. It just seems to me that people in favour of cultural appropriation arguments don't see Western civilization as a legitimate culture.
Isn't that interesting? Yeah, they see everything but Western culture, as real culture. You know what I mean? So Western culture, Western nominally secular culture, is seen as somehow non-culture, which is quite absurd.
It's not authentic.
It's not authentic. Yeah. In other words, it's not traditional.
Correct. Meaning it hasn't remained unchanged for centuries.
No, what a pity. If only we were still living as our forebears did in the 16th century or something like that, you know?
Yes. Yep. So
we'd be much better people for it, wouldn't we?
Well, we're all in favour of the Enlightenment here.
We are.
But not everybody is. No,
unfortunately. And, you know, people are so silly about the whole thing, you know? They look for reasons to be upset or offended. Don't they?
They do. Well, you know, sometimes it's more the advocates of the sort of privileged left who perhaps advocate more than the people they're advocating on behalf of. You know, really, I wouldn't be surprised if. You know, regressive left academics with leather patches on their elbows outnumber just genuine, you know, Latino population who are outraged by sombreros at a Halloween party or at a tequila themed university drink up. Like, it wouldn't surprise me if they actually outnumber the true.
Look, I did a little bit of anthropology at university, and I became interested in Indigenous peoples around the world. So I actually did a course at University of Queensland on specifically about Indigenous peoples of the world. And so I did a bit of reading about various Indigenous peoples. And I had a slightly different mindset about the whole thing then. That was some years ago. But I think, thinking back on it, there was this view that Indigenous cultures were somehow more pure and deserved to be wrapped in bubble wrap and preserved for all time. And that those people couldn't possibly be any happier or have better, richer, fuller, healthier lives if they absorbed any elements from the global civilization.
Yes.
If you know what I mean. In other words, there they were, these pristine, you know, the noble savage type thing.
Yes.
You know, how could we possibly offer them anything of value, anything that would make their lives better? We should just leave them alone, wall them off, you know, wrap them in bubble wrap.
Yes.
And do our damnedest not to contaminate them with our disgusting
Western civilization.
Yes, with, you know, medicine and education and all our highfalutin ideas about advancing human societies.
Yes.
And, you know, the more I think back on it, the more wrong-headed I think they were, to be honest.
Yes.
And we all know that life expectancy in a lot of these Indigenous societies is way below what we enjoy here in the West.
Yes.
We all know that without things like antibiotics, they can just be taken like that, you know.
Well, cultures will change over time.
And they do. Even Indigenous cultures
change. Because individuals within the culture will refuse to integrate into the group fully. They'll take certain aspects where they say, no, I'm not part of the group in this regard. I'm something different. So when do-gooding regressive leftists say that a culture shouldn't change, they're actually hamstringing and restricting people within the culture from a freedom.
Exactly, Trevor. And they make the assumption for those people that they don't want to change,
yes.
that they don't want anything different
yes.
to what their traditional, what their traditions dictate.
Yes.
It's a huge assumption and it's an extremely arrogant one.
Yes, yes. So so Kenan Malik says, you know, surely a culture is whatever it happens to be that the people are practicing at the time. But multiculturalists will argue that that's not the case. It should really be an authentic traditional culture that has been unchanged.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, that you're saying really people have to be practicing something that their ancestors did, then it all comes down to ancestry and race, that as a person you are defined by your race and yes. need to be doing what your race has always done.
Yeah. And of course race is a contestable
yes.
concept as well. But yes, you're right. And or at least we could say they have to conform with the traditions of their culture, whatever that may be.
Mm.
Of course we're exempt from that because we don't have any authentic culture.
Well, we've got that, you know. Well, that's right. People would say we don't. Others would say we do. Of course we do. Everyone's got a culture. It's just...
And our culture changes, and so does theirs, for goodness sake.
Well, they should. Yeah. So you and I are both fans of Kenan Malik and his views on culture.
Mm.
And his other sort of line on that is, why are we suddenly so keen on culture and identity? Just on identity, slight digression. While I was away on the weekend, I managed to read a little bit on an aeroplane about from the book Democracy for Realists. And I've mentioned it before, but the really detailed study of democracy and conclusion is we think democracy is grounded on rational choice, but in fact the general public is too busy to study policies, has an aversion to political disagreement, and makes voting decisions based on identity politics.
Yeah.
Here's an interesting statistic, 12 man. Voters look for politicians who match their identities. In the 2014-2015 House of Reps in the USA, 95% of districts with a black majority elected a black representative, while only 5% of white majority districts elected a black candidate. So blacks are electing blacks, whites are electing whites. The policies, to a large extent, don't matter. It's just an identity that a voter identifies with a particular group, and whatever they're doing in that group doesn't really matter. And that explains the whole Donald Trump phenomena.
Yeah.
And it sort of flows on from this Kenan Malik argument that we've regressed into identity politics. So in one sense with the secular party, I think, you know, we should really spend it for success on one level, you know, don't bother worrying about policies and nutting out the nuts and bolts of it because nobody will read them or care about them.
It's just presenting
an identity that they might identify with is the hard part.
Does that mean we're unelectable?
Well,
because we don't have a specific identity projection.
Well, this is where we have to manufacture one to an extent, to somehow, or at least describe one, or at least present a scenario where people would go, actually, I think I am that. I am in that category. I mean, there'd be lots of people who would go, I no longer identify with the Liberal Party because they are now being taken over by Tea Party religious nutbags.
Mm-hmm. Certainly they're being taken over by the conservative elements.
Who would just perhaps no longer identify with them. Yeah. So there's a group there. Anyway, it's, the multiculturalism leading to this identity politics and democracy is... But he also says that we've really given up on the broad social ideologies.
Yes, and he makes the point that whereas people used to be united by ideology across cultural lines. In other words, you know, back in the 20th century, you know, if you're a communist or whatever, you felt solidarity with other communists, regardless of skin colour, cultural background, whatever. If they were communists, you knew that you you shared a common vision for human material and moral progress.
It was a broad ideology that that would include a number of identities.
Well, yeah, it wasn't about identity. It was about common vision.
Yes.
And now, that perhaps as a result of people being disappointed or feeling let down by ideological politics,
I think perhaps now, the success of lobby groups, that people see lobby groups as being effective in getting things for groups, that they figure, I've got to join a smaller group to be... also, intellectual laziness, where people have not got the time to think about things.
And in that sense, we're... You know, politics has become a victim of our own success. Where, I mean, we certainly have seen material progress in large parts of the world in the last 50, 60 years.
Yeah.
And perhaps people have become complacent. You know, they take it for granted that society is going to continually get better and better, and they'll have bigger and bigger houses and more holiday homes and boats and cars, and at least in the Western world, of course. But I mean, they say that poverty has been materially reduced in the developing world. So perhaps we've become a victim of our own success, and people feel they don't need to be ideologically engaged anymore, because it's just a matter of who is going to get you another boat or another car. You know, which identity group are you going to align with?
Yes.
Who is in there batting for your
identity
group?
Yes, that's right.
So it's not about vision. It's not about universal values anymore.
Mm.
It's about groups competing with each other for advantage.
Yes. Well put, 12th man. I think that's...
Have I missed it? No, I'm sure I have missed a lot.
I think you've summed it up, sadly. I think you have. So how we are going to sway them to a universalist sort of
overall societal
view is the challenge. But we're up for it, 12th man.
We're up for it.
We're getting some good new recruits at the
secular
secular party meeting. A couple of new people. One's on board helping out with different things.
Yeah.
So we
need to continually, you know, ask for people in other states of Australia to consider forming groups with, you know, of people, like-minded people with vision like us.
Yes. Little identity group that we are.
To form little cells of secular party.
Yes, that's what we need.
Yeah.
So, dear listener.
So where are we needing these cells to spontaneously grow?
Well,
Western Australia? We don't have one?
We the only truly active one is Brisbane. I mean, I think Victoria and New South Wales get just two or three people, but not sadly. Enough. So... Brisbane is the most active,
it's the epicenter of the secular party at the moment.
It is. So we do need people on board in other areas. So look, we're going to be contacting atheist groups and rationalist groups and others, and maybe they
humanist
can...
Humanist groups.
Yes. So maybe... Because it is important. I think it's important for us to meet physically, face to face, once a month is good.
I do too.
Yeah,
I do too. I think it's extremely important.
Yeah. So we'll try and do something on Facebook as well, a sort of an online meeting of some point as well, and people can sort of post comments on Facebook, and we'll answer them online. So that's as a for people you know, because I've got a, you know, a thing for people in rural and remote areas who struggle.
Yeah, you have a lot of sympathy for that. You don't want any discrimination against
them. No, so we'll offer that opportunity. But all right, dear listener, we're going to wrap it up. The thoughts expressed here are not necessarily those of the Secular Party. For full details, look at the Secular Party website. While you're there, please join, pay your $25, help us out. Also, if you haven't already, like us on Facebook. Here's the next challenge. It would be really nice if you go onto iTunes and leave a positive review. Now, that takes a bit of doing, and on the website, there are directions of how to do it. 12th Man, have you ever done it?
I haven't.
Is that?
I have left a comment on your Facebook site, but
yeah,
I haven't.
Right, but you've never actually gone onto iTunes and... Yeah, yeah. It's,
yeah, I have to extend myself technologically, I suppose.
There you go. So so the options are there on the website for that. And otherwise, dear listener, thank you for your attention and we'll be back next week. Bye.
Bye, listeners.
Well, dear listener, did you enjoy that episode of the podcast? If you did, I've got a favour to ask. First up, tell some friends. Let them know about the podcast. You'll be discussing something at some time and you might be repeating something I've said. And when you're talking to your friends, say, hey, I heard this on this podcast and it's worth listening to. And maybe pick an episode that you think's a good one and direct them to it. Like grab their phone and go to their podcast app and search for Iron Fist Velvet Glove and subscribe on their behalf on their phone and just put the word out. The other thing is you could become a patron and support the show. So if you go to our website, you'll see a link to Patreon and there are some different options for subscribing and paying per episode. And really the amount that you pay depends on what you get from the podcasts. So there's different levels ranging from $1.50 Australian to I think $10 and various ones in between. It's really, what do you think it's worth? Is it worth a cup of coffee? Is it worth more than that, less than that? Whatever you get out of it, because not everybody gets the same. Maybe you don't listen to the whole thing. Maybe you never talk about it with people. Maybe you really couldn't care less half the time whether the podcast is there. It just, it'll be different for everybody. So if you get a lot out of the podcast, contribute a bit more. If you don't get much, contribute less. But in any event, you can subscribe there. If you don't like the idea of a regular subscription, the website has a link to a PayPal donation. So you could just do a one-off donation every now and again. So there you go. It'd be good to spread the word, get a few more listeners. And that way, look, if we ended up getting more listeners and more money, we could do maybe a second episode or more special episodes, provide some more content. So it's up to you. If you think it's worthwhile, let people know. Thanks.